Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Switching gears now, and I've got a little fact for you as we start this portion of the program. Did you know that only 1% of the water on Earth is usable, and 99% of that usable water is groundwater? And this is Groundwater Awareness Week, National Groundwater Awareness Week, so a perfect time to have our two guests with us today. Lisa Lehman Kerler, Private Water Section Chief for the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at our Wisconsin DNR. Lisa, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
And Kevin Masaryk is an outreach specialist for the Center for Watershed Science and Education at UW-Stevens Point. Kevin, great to see you as well.
You as well. Thanks for having me.
You know, before we even start talking about groundwater, talk about your agencies for a minute. Lisa, tell us about the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater.
Thanks, Larry. Yeah, the at DNR, we regulate the construction of private wells and a certain amount of testing that goes along with that. But our primary focus is actually on public drinking water systems and the federal regulations that apply there. We do have a section in our program that looks more specifically at groundwater, tries to evaluate trends in groundwater quality and quantity to help us make good decisions about protecting that resource and helping people to use it.
Well, and Kevin, let's turn to you. What about the Center for Watershed Science and Education at UW-Stevens Point?
So the center is housed at UW-Stevens Point. It's also affiliated with UW Extension. So our organization really works with stakeholders that rely on groundwater. A lot of that has to do with well owners and helping them feel more comfortable with making decisions about their private water supply. Another component of what we do is groundwater education. So I facilitate workshops for teachers, communities, helping them really understand a resource that's underground and a lot of people don't often think about.
Yeah, for sure. And here we've got a week, a whole week set aside for groundwaters. Why is that important? As an educator, I'm pretty sure you feel it is.
As an educator, again, it's a resource we don't often think about. And this time of year in particular is really important for groundwater. It's the time of year when we get most of our groundwater recharge. The snow's melting. We're going to get spring rains, and there's not a lot of vegetation to take up or evaporate that water. So because it's a primary time of groundwater recharge, it's also a time of year when our well water is going to be a little bit more susceptible or reactive to infiltration events. And it's a good time to test people's water if they rely on private wells.
Somebody asked me, how the heck is groundwater formed to begin with?
So groundwater, it's a local resource.
Okay.
And contrary to popular belief, it's going to come from rain or snowmelt, some of which is going to infiltrate down through the soil, eventually reach a point where all the empty space in the soil and rock are filled with water. So it's not an underground lake. It's not an underground river. It's just the water that occupies the empty space in the soil and rock below our feet.
Yeah. And someone else asked me, what about how do we keep it safe? There's always issues that come up one thing or another. Lisa, I know DNR is dealing with this all the time. How do we keep it safe?
There's a lot of ways that are happening at a lot of different levels to protect groundwater. One of the things that Kevin and I try to work with regularly is helping private well owners understand how to manage their own property to have safe drinking water. But land use regulations that are happening at the local level are definitely designed to help make sure that activities that are done are protective. DNR administers regulations under the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act to regulate things like manure spreading or industrial land spreading so that's done in a way that it doesn't result in contamination to groundwater.
Yes, just sort of along that line, Greg on Facebook sent a note in, wonders if he should be concerned about drinking wastewater from places like fracking or coal fly ash. Will they contaminate groundwater, or do they have the potential? So, Kevin, turn to you for that.
Yeah, so when it comes to fracking, Wisconsin doesn't have any economically viable deposits of oil or natural gas, which would involve or utilize the fracking process. What Wisconsin does have, however, is frack sand. And that's a sand that's mined. It's removed from the earth, and it's mostly a physical process. So it's not the same type of concern that places out east or in the Dakotas would have related to the fracking process itself. Regarding coal fly ash, that is an area where landfilling of coal fly ash sometimes would release metals into the soil and potentially into the groundwater. So things like molybdenum, arsenic, there's some additional tests that a homeowner might want to consider if they live around an area with a coal fly ash landfill.
Let's talk about that whole process about testing and so forth, Lisa.
Yeah, thanks. The DNR and the Groundwater Center, we recommend that people test their private wells every year for bacteria. That's the microorganisms that can make you sick right away. Nitrates and arsenic are also contaminants that we encourage people to test for regularly. If you're in an agricultural area or an area of a lot of septic systems, that can be introducing nitrates into the groundwater. Arsenic, we used to think that was most common in the northeast part of the state, but it has been found at elevated levels throughout the state. It's a naturally occurring metal that's in our geology in Wisconsin, but it can have some health concerns if you have elevated levels in your drinking water. So those are the top three contaminants that we encourage people to test for. The easiest way to do it is to call a local laboratory, find out if they're certified to test for those parameters. They'll send you a kit with instructions. You can collect your own samples. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, you can contact a local well professional that can help you with doing the sampling. And then the labs will send you the test results back and usually give you some advice on what they mean.
Yeah. We had my parents had a home with a private well, and we've tested, and I was involved in the testing. It's pretty straightforward, really.
Most people have no problem doing it on their own. Like Lisa said, if you're not comfortable, if you get the request a test kit from the lab and you don't quite feel comfortable doing that sampling procedure yourself, you can call a well driller or a pump installer to do that for you. But the instructions are relatively simple. There's some additional things you want to pay attention to. You want to make sure you're using a sterile bottle or the right bottle for the test that you're performing. And that's something that you'd want to obviously call the lab first to make sure that you're sampling according to how they want it done.
Yeah.
Larry, I'd like to add, at this time of year, as Kevin mentioned, our groundwater is getting replenished by snowmelt and rainwater, but it's also more vulnerable, so it is a time we encourage people to test. At any time of year, if a private well owner notices a change in their water quality, that's really important to test it. If you have any suspicion, if it changes the color or smell or appearance, odor, taste, that's a good hint that something could be going wrong, and it might be the well construction or it might be contamination, but that's always a good time to test.
I haven't given the number, I don't think, so let me do that right now. 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And there is a cost that's obviously associated with this. I was trying to remember what it is, but it's not huge.
Yeah, it's definitely going to vary depending on where you send a sample, but most labs are going to be relatively cost competitive with one another. For a bacteria test, I would say anywhere between $20 and $30 for a nitrate test. You might be looking at around $20 to $25. And for an arsenic test, probably $20 to $25 as well. Just a general ballpark. Obviously, each lab is going to be a little bit different.
Yeah, and so if you're doing that once a year, maybe if you figured it out on a monthly basis, is, you know, $4 or $5 a month maybe at the most.
To remove the uncertainty over the quality of the water that you're using on a daily basis, I think it's money well spent.
Yeah. Paul in Gills Rock has something for us. Hi, Paul.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, so we've got our own personal well up here, and the house was built 20-some years ago, and that there's a really strong sulfur smell. The only guys that we can use are Culligan, and they tell us the water's fine. And, yeah, we have a really big iron problem. We've got we have an RO system. We have chlorine. And I'm constantly concerned about the water. And I don't really know of any other options other than relying on Culligan to.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm sure that's a question that other people have as well. And you know what? We're going to ponder that because we need to take a quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. But there is a line open for you, a 1-800-642-1234. If you don't get through, you can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Kevin Masaryk, our guest from UW-Stevens Point, Lisa Lehman-Curler with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And we'll be back right after the news. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. You know, 44% of the U.S. population depends on groundwater for its drinking water supply. And we're talking about groundwater today with our two guests, Kevin Masaryk and Lisa Lehman-Curler. Kevin, outreach specialist for the Center for Watershed Science and Education at UW-Stevens Point. Lisa, private water section chief for the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at our Wisconsin DNR. Questions to them about groundwater? I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, and you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Just look for the Ideas Network page. And just before we broke for news, Paul from Gills Rock, I believe that's in Door County, has a problem with the water, their drinking water. It's iron, apparently has iron in it. It has a sulfur smell, and yet the company, the private company says that he's working with, says it's, there's not a problem with the water. Kevin, do you want to take that?
Yeah, so this is a excellent illustration of how groundwater and geologic materials influence the groundwater quality in some parts of the state. And I think when they say there's nothing wrong with the water, they might be saying that it doesn't exceed or register unsafe for any health-related contaminants. And that might be true. A lot of the common complaints or calls that I receive are related to aesthetic or visual things regarding people's drinking water. And in that part of the state, Door County, we know there can be elevated sulfate, which also might register as kind of a rotten egg odor when that sulfate becomes reduced and gives water that cotton rotten egg smell, and might manifest itself by elevated levels of iron, which could cause staining on fixtures or staining of laundry. And this is an example, again, where the geology really is the primary reason for those concerns. And there might be limited ability for well construction or other types of avenues to alleviate the problem, and treatment might be the only option in some of these situations.
Yeah, I was trying to think about filters that a person might use. Are there filters that you could, say, attach to your faucet or whatever?
Yes, there are, and that's what a water treatment company can help up, help a well owner with, definitely iron filters or something to help manage the sulfur. Like Kevin said, these are, they can be distasteful, yeah. Or the odor, or cause problems on your fixtures. They won't cause health concerns. So that's the good news.
Yeah, that's the good news for sure. Well, let's take some more calls. Palmer in Eau Claire, I think it's your turn next. Hi, Palmer. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hey. I got it. My question is, we have a spring that flows quite fast and has been there while we used to use water from it, but not no more. Where does all that water come from? When it, if some college people came around a year or so ago and checked the flow of it, and it was, I can't guarantee this, but I think they told me it was 94 gallons per minute coming out of there. They put a apparatus in the creek below it.
Wow.
But where does all that water come from? How far a distance underground does it come? Another question, where that, when we used it, you could walk in that, it was solid rock where that was coming up. Now, how come that doesn't wash out and when it runs for all them years, or eons probably, not make a big hole there where it comes out?
All right.
Yeah, Palmer, that sounds like a neat spot that you've got there. We do have springs throughout Wisconsin in different places, and it's really a factor of the local geology and what's happening underground with the groundwater and the rock or soil. So the easiest way to think of why a spring occurs is simply that the aquifer, the groundwater, you know, just gets filled up to the point where it's got enough pressure that it can be released to the ground to the surface. It might be through a fracture. It might be coming off of the side of a hill, and depending on the amount of pressure, is going to determine how much it flows. Some people might notice they might call spring water or a seep coming out of the side of the hill just in the springtime when, like Kevin was talking about, the groundwater is being replenished and it's building up a little more pressure and then it comes to the surface, and then other times of the year it might not do that. So it can be very variable. Trout fishermen in southwestern Wisconsin are counting on that spring water to be the source of the cold water streams that we have in that part of the state.
And then in terms of the hole or not, the lack of a hole, Palmer was saying, why don't, all these years that's been coming through, why don't we have a hole there?
Some materials are just more resistant to weathering than others. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the aquifers in Wisconsin are either sandstone or dolomite. And sandstone is basically sand or silica, yeah, quartz grains. And that's a very resistant material to weathering, whereas dolomite does weather, but that weathering takes place over millions of years, and the size of the crack might take a long, long time to develop, and we aren't going to see much weathering in our lifetimes.
Yeah, if you live to be 300, maybe you'll see a little bit. but there you go, Palmer. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Let's go to John in Rhinelander next. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Nice sunny day up here. I just wanted to ask about manure runoff, because the way I understood it is regular manure sitting in the field, or they spread with a regular manure spreader, isn't that bad? It stays there and it goes in the soil. But the problem was this liquefied manure, where they have a factory farm and they use water to get rid of the manure, then they dilute it 10-1. Next thing you know, the groundwater's full of it, and the wetlands, and then the streams and the rivers. Next thing you know, you got a dead zone in Green Bay. And you know, Iowa probably doesn't have one bit of safe drinking water anymore because of these CAFOs. We want to prevent that here.
Well, let's get have some comments here. Lisa, do you want to start?
Sure. John, I think that you've got some good observations about there are certainly differences between liquid and solid manure. We're America's dairyland, and one of the things that comes along with that is there's a lot of manure that has to be dealt with. And farmers use that manure to supplement their soil so that it helps with the crops. And if it's properly land spread or properly managed, both solid and liquid manure can, be incorporated into the soil and not run off. But if they're placed on the soil at the wrong time of year, where you have rain or the ground is frozen, or in the case of liquid manure, if it's not incorporated into the soil, then it can become a problem to our surface waters. Some parts of the state, like northeastern Wisconsin, have more fractured geology, and so it's very easy for that manure material to get into the groundwater because there's not enough soil on the surface to keep it out of those fractures and bedrock layers. So it's a big challenge to manage the manure correctly, and it's definitely something that we have regulations in DNR for the larger farms. They do have to have management plans to make sure they're addressing the manure properly.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Doug in La Crosse next. Hi, Doug. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a water sample actually return the results this morning, as a matter of fact, so the timing is great here. The well I have is in southeastern Minnesota, just, 4 miles across the Mississippi from La Crosse. And the question I have is about nitrates. The sampling I had done was for coliform and E. coli, which were absent. And then the nitrate result came back, which was good. It was less than the 10 milligrams per liter. But I was curious, the analysis showed an LOD of 1 and an LOQ of 3 milligrams per liter. I was wondering if you could explain what that meant.
LOD and LOQ. Kevin, turn to you for that.
So these are terms that chemists and lab people might geek out on, so to speak. They're technical jargon, but I hope to maybe lend some or shed some light on those. LOD stands for limited detection. So that's the detection level of the equipment that they're using. I tend to think of it like a bathroom scale. Mm-hmm. If you were to put a piece of paper on your bathroom scale, you could see that there's something on that scale, but that bathroom scale just isn't sensitive enough to measure that there's some sort of mass on there. So that's limited detection. Is the instrument capable of measuring that nitrate is there? And then limited quantification is the level at which the lab is confident that the number they're reporting back to you is that actual number. Okay. So the fact that it's 3, if it's less than the LOD, it means you can be confident it's less than 1 milligram per liter. If the limited quantification is 3 and you test, let's say, 2, the equipment is saying it's there, and that's kind of a rough ballpark estimate of the concentration, but they can't say with a lot of certainty that it's exactly 2 milligrams per liter.
Mm-hmm. And Lisa, you wanted to add to that.
I just would like to add that I was really glad to hear that Doug tested for bacteria and nitrates. And total coliform, you mentioned, Doug, that's the standard test that laboratories run for bacteria. So if you hear that phrase, total coliform, that's a group of bacteria species that are kind of the standard test that's used to see if there might be a bigger problem in your well. And then E. coli is a particular species of bacteria that is more likely to make people sick. So when you hear total coliform or E. coli, those are kind of the standard bacteria tests.
Yeah. And Doug, you had something to add, I believe.
I was just mentioning that my next test now, La Crosse County does this for basically anybody in the area, and those tests were like $27 per test, so that round of testing was $54. I'm going to send a sample in probably tomorrow for metal testing, and that actually goes down to the state, and that I believe is like $95. So to your point of if you do that once a year, it's
not a huge amount.
Pretty cheap. So
yeah. Thank you very much, Doug. Appreciate it. Pat had emailed to say the city of Waukesha tests too, and it's, for $25 easy and inexpensive. So going along with what Doug just said. Thanks again, Doug. Let's go to Jim in La Crosse next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'd just like to ask a question about the Wisconsin Nutrient Management Plan, and that's how the state regulates basically farming. I feel it's not really working. We have a lot of groundwater around La Crosse with very high nitrate, like over 20 when the limit's 10. And I'm just wondering, how can we have any influence on that Wisconsin nutrient management plan and improve it?
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Let's turn to Kevin for that. Kevin?
So nutrient management plans are kind of the best management practices that we'd recommend for farmers. And in some parts of the state, those plans, those practices are going to be good enough to keep water quality safe and drinkable for the people that rely on it as their drinking water source. In other areas, like Lisa mentioned, where we have shallow soils overlying carbonate rock, or areas where we have very sandy or coarse textured soils, and I believe the areas of La Crosse you're probably talking about fall into that category of very sandy soils. Those are areas where water and nutrients can move through the soil much more quickly, and as a result, it's much more difficult to say that a nutrient management plan on its own is going to be capable of protecting groundwater. A lot of times we know that the amount of nitrogen that's applied to a crop is a function of what a particular field is growing. Crops like corn require more nitrogen than a crop like soybeans or alfalfa. So if you're looking at improving groundwater quality, one thing we'd recommend is to diversify maybe cropping rotations to include some crops that require less nitrogen. That's easy for me to say as somebody that doesn't farm. It's less certain in my mind how we go about instituting that change on a landscape scale.
We do. I think we do more of it probably than many other states. Some of the western states, it's corn, beans, corn, beans, corn, beans. And we do a pretty good job on alfalfa, growing alfalfa. And I think that corn, that rotation is a more helpful rotation.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I appreciate the caller bringing up the issue of nitrates, because there is certainly is growing awareness of that there's nitrates in our groundwater, and growing recognition that we need to have a broad strategy for how to address the sources of it and how to protect our groundwater, people's drinking water.
Another thing to keep in mind, too, is that a lot of the ways in which we've historically grown crops, we have a plant on the landscape only during the growing season. That leaves a large part of the year where there might not be an actively growing plant. So cover crops and soil health are a lot of big initiatives that are being looked at as ways to help with this particular issue. And I'm cautiously optimistic that those things will help, although I want to be upfront that it's not going to get us to no nitrate in the water.
Yeah,
that's really difficult to do.
Well, to Paul's question about nutrient management plans, how does, you know, he's wondering how do you get an input on that, or how do you get them changed? It's not the same nutrient management plan versus for the whole state, or can you get difference?
Right. The nutrient management plan is something that's developed for a farm. And so it's how they manage their manure, their fertilizers, and things like that, that they use to supplement their soils. So there's not really a state nutrient management plan. There are state regulations that govern the application of materials by farms. And there's actually just been some, DNR's been working on improving the standards for the areas in the northeastern part of the state that, again, have that vulnerable geology with shallow soils. And so that's going to be a step in the right direction of reducing the likelihood that that material will get into our groundwater.
Just as an aside, I think the technology in terms of planting and fertilizing anymore. I've got friends who farm that, you know, the fertilizer goes into the soil for different plants almost in the same field, depending on the soil at a particular spot in the field. So that sort of technology, one would hope, would also help in the long run.
There's a lot of technologies that, you know, we look at split application of fertilizers or variable rate application of nitrogen, and those do have potential. A lot of them are what I would consider to be risk management strategies that keep the nitrogen in the soil and give it the best opportunity to be taken up by the plant. And in a dry year or an average year, those techniques work pretty well. But we can't always predict the weather, so you know, there might be things beyond our control that don't completely eliminate the risk, but do help minimize that risk.
Yeah, So lots of things to consider there. Jim, thank you so much. Diane in Greene County, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I'm renting a house in the country, and there's agricultural near it, and I'm wondering if I can have a soil test done as not being the owner but renting.
You mean a water test, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Yes, Diane, absolutely. And you can do that yourself. If you're renting the place, you would have access to the pressure tank or a place to sample the water from, either in your basement or a kitchen tap if you don't have access to some other kind of place to do the sampling. So you can do just exactly what you would be able to do if you were a well owner and, you know, get a test kit from a local laboratory and collect the samples and send them in.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you for calling. And let's see. Ron in Thiensville, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, hi. See, my concern is I'm in a residential area that depends on groundwater for their water supply. And my concern is with the accumulating effects of these lawn care services that are quite popular and eliminating weeds from lawns, and if these chemicals have a cumulal effect on the water table.
Yeah.
So that's a great question, and we talked a lot about how, you know, land use in agricultural areas influence groundwater. Mm-hmm. But if we consider any one individual well, kind of a rule of thumb I give people is look what's happening within about a half mile radius of your well. And certainly if you're in an area that's much more urban, you might be obviously more concerned about how people are treating their lawns, what chemicals or herbicides or pesticides are they using in addition to how much fertilizer. And we do see that in areas that are more urban where people might be fertilizing, some of that nitrate is getting through. We would expect that if nitrate is getting through, regardless of whether it's coming from lawn care or agricultural, that some of the pesticides that are used in those areas might be breaking through as well. And the other thing I'd mention, I don't know if Thiensville has, you know, if this is an area that's private wells and septic systems, but septic systems also, as much as we want them to be water treatment systems for groundwater, septic systems do a pretty good job of treating for things like bacteria, but less effective for nitrate or chloride or personal care products that might be released into the wastewater.
So he should be, Rod and probably a neighbor's ought to be testing their water then.
Absolutely.
So once a year, again, is that the standard?
Well, particularly if he's concerned that there's a lot of lawn care chemicals and fertilizer, you know, once a year for nitrates would be a good rule of thumb along with bacteria. And as Kevin indicated, if the nitrates are getting in, then that suggests that other pesticides and fertilizer could be as well. Nitrate is a simple test that's relatively inexpensive. And then if that's high, you can do further testing if you want.
Well, on that note, boy, the time flew. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate you spending the time, Lisa and Kevin. I'm sure you'll be back.
Would love to.
Love to have you back. Lisa Lehman-Kurler with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Kevin Masaryk with the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, our guest. We'll have him back and we'll do it again. Thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.